Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. My name is Fernando Arencibia, and with me, as always, is the sometimes conflicted Jennifer Wollman. Jennifer, say hi.
Hi.
That only happens, by the way, being conflicted is a good thing. That only happens when you're a very thoughtful person, when you're a deep thinker.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think about what that means.
When you have the ability. No, it's something that in our society is often, I think lately, undervalued, which is your ability to look at multiple angles, multiple perspectives, and be a little conflicted about what is the right choice, and then you work through it. But having that ability to be accept the possibility that you might be wrong is, I think you would agree, something that sometimes in our society is lacking. It's okay. You're not supposed to know everything. You're not supposed to.
I definitely don't know anything.
Make quick decisions about every single thing that you're gonna do. You know, it's okay to be conflicted. Well, anyway, that's not what we're talking about today, guys. But one of the things that we often come across is when we're talking about real estate as a whole and commercial real estate is how different the experience is when you are going through the underwriting process in a commercial loan versus a residential loan.
Correct.
Right. And we thought today we would kind of break down what are some of those differences and some of those experiences. Before we do that, I wanted to ask you, do you remember the first time you went through that process? You know, you've been in real estate for a long time. When you started, was your first deal a residential deal or a commercial deal?
My first deal was a commercial lease.
A commercial lease.
Deals, so to be honest with you, I don't think much thought goes into residential underwriting.
Right.
Right? It's pretty much if you want a mortgage, you want to buy a house, this is what you have to follow. And it's a place to live, so it's a little bit different. So,
but you know, like many people in real estate, you came from another industry. When you dived into real estate, you already had owned a home. You had already gone through a mortgage process of your own.
Correct.
So you already had that experience of.
Correct. Of having had a mortgage. Now my, you know, underwriting an investment property was totally different. It's talk about being conflicted. That is where I think I've spoken before about how even though I had done underwriting for clients and I felt really good about my first deal, fear kind of got into the picture, even though I had done all of my underwriting process and I felt good. Right. And it's helped me. It helped prevent me from getting into a deal. I just loved the property, but the underwriting made zero sense. That was a beautiful, beautiful building in Stuart. And that's where underwriting helps you in a commercial process, right? It takes the emotion out of the deal. Right. And especially if you have a specific set of, I guess, strategies that you stick to. Like most investors that I know either invest in one asset class or they invest in one area in a variety of asset classes, but they have certain givens, right? They know that they're either fix and flippers or they know that they're longtime holders. They know what they want their returns to be. They know the area that they want to invest in. And I think underwriting commercial properties is a way to protect yourself from the emotional side of real estate.
But the first experience you had in the commercial underwriting process was not for your own commercial investment. It was through the experience of one of your clients, or that was not the case?
No, it was for my own. It was for my own investment property, because with my first couple of clients in commercial real estate, I didn't get into their underwriting.
Got it.
Right. They had their own person. They were very. She is. Was a savvy investor. She did a lot of multifamily investing. And the funny thing with her, and I've talked about her on the show before, she actually didn't underwrite. Like, she went in, and if it felt good, because she knew she was very hyper specific in her market, she only did multifamily and only did multifamily in Coral Gables. Yeah. If she walked into a building, she either liked it or didn't like it. If she liked it, she bought it. Like,
right.
So she pretty much left most of the underwriting up to her lender.
Right.
She didn't care about the numbers so much. It was like, if the bank will lend me the number, you know, lend me the money I want. So that's been my experience with commercial. Most of the commercial underwriting that I've done has been for properties that I've invested in.
Yeah. But you're talking about the underwriting you're talking about is underwriting the deal itself to see if it makes sense, to see if it's a worthy investment. For me, I had done a lot of residential, so I had gone through, you know, and I was a mortgage broker, so I started in the residential mortgage side, never really dipped myself into the commercial side because it was a totally different world, and it's not where the focus was at the company that I was at. And but I do remember, you know, selling my first property in Little Havana, which came with financing, and there were a few things that struck me to be very, at the time, very weird, which is that the loan officer for the local community bank went to visit the property before there was even full application and all that other stuff. And so I thought that that was a really interesting dynamic because, you know, I had never seen a loan officer for a residential transaction visit the property.
Right.
And not only did they visit the property on this commercial deal, but they wanted to get to know the area. You know, what is the community like? What are the things that are attracting you to this investment? And I would say that it was, you know, very much about taking on a partner, you know, which is not the way you really think about when you're looking at the mortgage side on the residential side. And there are other aspects of the process that are really interesting. For example, if when you're a broker and you are transacting in a residential deal, you usually will ask for a pre-qualification letter from the prospective buyer. That really doesn't exist on the commercial world. You know, they got to look at the deal first. You got to have it on their contract, and then you get what is called the term sheet. But then, of course, once they package everything together, it has to go to a committee within the bank. And then that dynamic was also interesting. What the committee saw, where, you know, were they comfortable with the loan amount, were they comfortable with the investment? You know, there were so many different things that were interesting about it. So the experience made us think about having this episode where we discuss what are some of the differences and started to organize what are the differences. One of the things that I think it's important is to, from a mindset perspective, and I wanted to get your thought to see if you think if this is something that, you know, resonates with you, which is that in the residential is more borrower centric, commercial is more asset centric. That on the residential side, the lenders assess the person, the income, their credit worthiness, personal debt obligations. In commercial, the lenders assess the property, its income, stability, potential to generate returns. That has more of a weight than, I mean, those other things are evaluated for sure. But in the commercial world, it has more of a weight.
I would say that, yeah, it does have more of a weight. The asset itself has more of a weight in commercial. But I think most lenders, especially local lenders, also look at the buyer and the buyer's experience in commercial.
Absolutely.
Whereas on the residential side, they don't care if you've ever owned a home before or not. They just want to know if you can pay the mortgage and expenses, unforeseen expenses associated with with home ownership.
So let's go through some of these things in the list. You want to just go through some of them?
Sure, but I'm going to do a quick, I guess, caveat or say,
yeah.
Like, I thought I... Sure. Misunderstood. I didn't realize it was a comparison that we were doing in okay. underwriting between residential and commercial. So okay. that's fine. I think we pursue that. What I had done is I went through how I underwrite a deal, right? Or the different steps okay. in underwriting a commercial deal. So I think it can still work. And
sure.
as we said before, people, I'm not lying. Fernando and I don't talk about the episode.
Well, I think this will be a great thing for you to go through that, and then for me to share how a commercial underwriter in a bank will underwrite the loan, because I think you know there are some things that you're going to find that has a layer of similarity, and then I think also when you're an investor, it's important for you to not only understand how you're going to underwrite your own deal, but how the bank is going to look at it if you're going to get debt on the property so that you have more leverage, so that your internal rate of return is higher, so that you have, you know, your cash on cash, all those other metrics that are important to investors are on point. So tell me a little bit about how you underwrite a deal.
So first of all, I always look at rental income and cash flow. For me, on an investment side, that is the most important. A lot of people look more at the appreciation side, or they give it equal weight. I don't. I look at cash flow.
So when you look at cash flow, here's a question for you, because I've had this debate. So usually when you have a property on the market, as a commercial broker, you create an offering memorandum that has a breakdown of income expenses. It gives you information about the area. It gives you information about the property, all of those things. There are some that also create, when they give you the numbers, they tell you this is what it's renting for today. But then it also gives you a pro forma of what it could rent for based on the current market, what the market is bearing. Right. Do you like seeing those pro forma, or you want to just go off?
I'll do my own. And I think that's something really interesting, that if you're a broker, what you put forward always depends on who you're representing. Right.
True.
So if you're representing the seller and the seller is asking for a very low cap rate, mm-hmm. then you're going to base it on pro forma. Right. Versus a buyer who's going to say, like, okay, no, I'm not going to buy it based on what could be done to the property or what the property could be producing.
Right.
I'm going to base it on what it's currently producing. So that's kind of why I go there. And that's why I want the current rent roll, and I want it to be the actual rent roll.
Right.
So I'll ask for leases. I'll ask for the actual rent roll. I'll ask for a T12, which is the trailing 12-month income and expense reports.
Right.
And again, on all of these, I want actual, not the projected or the scheduled or the what ifs, because a lot of times, to your point, they'll do the pro forma for the income, but then they don't do the pro forma for the expenses. So right. they'll use current expenses.
Or they will underestimate what new insurance would be, or what new taxes would be,
et cetera.
Yeah. They overestimate the rent and they underestimate the expenses.
Correct, right. Which is why, to me, the underwriting side from a purchaser side is so important.
So it's really interesting, because I'm looking at this list, and one of the categories is documentation requirements. And, you know, in the commercial world, so the list is there, the rent roll, the trailing 12-month operating statement, lease agreements, borrower financial. So it's all the same documentation that the bank is going to look at to evaluate the asset.
Right. Yeah. And it's also a way for you to start to piece together the story of the property, right?
Yeah.
How has it been managed? Looking at expenses, you can kind of get a pretty good idea if there's going to be a lot of deferred maintenance items, or you can pretty much tell if it's been maintained very well. Obviously, in Florida, you're also going to want, especially in Southeast Florida, you're going to want the 40-year certification. If it's an older property, so you can see, you're going to want that report, and you're going to want to do all that. So that's where I start. And then the operating expenses, again, I want the trailing 12 months of operating expenses, because I don't know if I only get, even though I'm only getting the current month rent roll plus the trailing 12-month income and expense report, if I only get the current month's expenses. I don't know if they just did, you know, put in a ton of money that month to fix stuff up, or if it's been maintained all along. So I want to see that. Also, a lot of depending on if it's an owner operator or an owner managed property, they might not put in expenses that I would want, or they might have expenses included that I'm not going to have. So that allows me to then go to the next part of my underwriting, which is projecting all of the costs I'm going to need after closing. So in commercial real estate, there, I mean, in my experience, I haven't had one example where I've purchased a property that there's nothing had to be done when we got it.
Yeah.
And another example of this is my partner, Natasha Falcone, and we're going to be interviewing her later on this year, but she does multifamily and she does value add, and her pro forma, she knows going in all the items that she's going to be changing in a building. So her first year probably is a cash outlay, right? Not cash income. So you need to calculate those projected costs because you want to make sure you have those included in your financials at closing, right? You want to have the cash. You don't want to be thinking that, okay, it's making this much, I'm going to bump up the rents and I'm going to use that difference to pay for my expenses, because it's not going to be enough to get it done. Right. So I don't know if you want to stop and add anything there.
No. I think I did have a question about that, which is how do you evaluate items that are probably going to need replacement in 5 years versus something that you're going to need to replace within the first 5 years of owning the property?
So I start with what I need to replace right away, right? Like I'll look at a property and I'll know that a roof needs to be redone, that grease traps probably need to be updated, that drainage needs to be done. And I know there's a particular property that I'm thinking of. So I'll think of that. And I know that that money immediately goes into my projection, knowing that I have to have that cash available at closing, because that's what's going to help me raise the rents as I renegotiate leases or bring in new higher paying tenants. So,
but once you have identified a certain cost to that, how does that factor into the offer that you're going to make for the property?
What do you mean?
You have a certain amount of capital expenses that you're going to have to make within the first year of owning that property.
Yeah.
So when you go into, but once you make that investment, you're going to benefit from the asset itself is going to benefit from those improvements, because you're going to be able to increase rents. You know, if you did your calculations right, there's going to be a multiple years of value that you're going to add by making that investment into the asset. But how do you, having a large CapEx on the first year, how does that affect the way that you approach the negotiations for acquiring the asset?
Well, I think it depends on where they're priced. If it's a building that needs a lot of CapEx going in and they're pricing themselves as if they're brand new construction, then it's definitely a part of the equation. If they're not and they're priced similar to other buildings that need the same CapEx, and other properties that have sold nearby had similar issues. And that, I think, is the same in residential, right? I mean, you can look at a neighborhood and be like, okay, most of these homes need a new roof.
Right.
And you can tell the price difference or the money that was given at closing because they found during inspection something to do with the new roof.
Correct.
But if that house is priced as if it was built yesterday,
there's
an issue there. So I think it comes more to the price of the property than it does. And I do think, because most of what I like doing is value add, then that's already a given that I'm going to get my money on the outside when I improve the property, bump the rents, et cetera. So I think it depends more on where the seller is at, if they're at a realistic price per square foot based on the condition of the property, the location of the property, et cetera, compared to other options that are out for investment.
So obviously in commercial lending, the lender is going to look at the same thing, because if it's more asset centric, they're going to look at the ability of that asset to perform. Any big items, particularly that have to be expended in that first, you know, the first 3 years, you know, within the first 5 years, but really within that first year. So you as an investor that is going to get a loan, you know, you have three hats that you wear when you're underwriting. You know, you wear the hat of the lender as well, because you're also considering how is the lender going to look at a roof that needs to be replaced today.
Well, and a lot of them, that's why I always include CapEx, because most of the lenders will require that you have that money at closing.
Correct.
And for example, I had a client who had a single tenant building. It was an office building. There was one tenant in the building. Right. The lender made them put away 3 years worth of rental income.
Yeah.
Because they said if that tenant leaves, you're empty.
Yeah.
And based on the location of the building and the demand for office, and guess what? That tenant left.
Yeah.
And they had to go in, they had to revamp, they had to do tenant improvements, they had to get creative with that property. Yeah. So those kind of things will help you, one, protect your investment, but two, also help speed along the underwriting from the lender side as well.
Because there is another hat that you wear, because you wear it because the bank also wears it, which is the insurance factor on the building, because you know the bank may decide it's okay for you to acquire it, leave a certain amount of money in order to create the roof. They'll ask you for quotes from two or three roofers so that they have an idea of what it's going to cost to replace the roof. They might ask you for 150% of that money to be left in escrow to make sure that there is room for, you know, or it might be 130%, 120% of the cost of replacing the roof in this example, in order for you to, you know, to make it happen. And then they'll give you draws as the roof is getting done. What is interesting there is also that there's another component, which is that you might not be able to insure it from day one. So you might have to get creative with the insurance in order for the lender to be comfortable to do the lending. It's interesting to denote that, you know, you as an underwriter, when you're underwriting the deal as an investor, and when the bank is underwriting the deal, another thing to consider is the bank is always going to be more conservative.
Correct.
They're going to partner. They want to partner on the deal, but it's going to be commensurate with the risk, which is why, for example, in residential, you could get up to 97%, almost 100% of the value of the property. But, you know, in commercial, you're going to get, you know, 60 to 75% depending. And another component that happens that is interesting is when we're talking about underwriting is you're underwriting an asset as an investment. There are parties that are buying assets for their own business, their owner-occupied properties of their business. So their underwriting is also a little bit different. And the bank will underwrite those things differently as well.
Right.
So some of the CapEx, for example, since we're kind of combining these two things, some of the CapEx for an owner-occupied could be very different because the bank may lend you a percentage of not only the acquisition, but also the percentage of the cost of making those improvements. And when they go and send the appraiser, they'll ask the appraiser to give me a value of the property as is and a value of the property as completed based on the list of upgrades that we know we want to make within the first year.
Correct.
And then they'll lend you on a percentage of the as completed, but they will separate the part that has to do with, you know, the investment of stuff, and they will basically give you a draw on that money, you know, and those things are always based on the relationship with
an investor. You can do that a lot in multifamily, right? If you're doing multifamily, there are a lot of loans that you can get the loan based on once you improve the units and I'm, I guess, conflicted. So I always do three scenarios. I do a best case scenario, a worst case scenario, and a most likely scenario. The bank usually is somewhere between my worst case and my middle of the road and my most likely. But then I always price it on my most likely. And it's interesting because I was talking to somebody the other day who was interested in buying a residential unit as an investment property, and Airbnb Airbnb-ing it.
Right.
And they showed me all the numbers, and I said, yeah, those numbers look great based on Airbnb. Yes, that appears to be right based on the rents that people are getting in the area, and I compared it against hotel daily rates and everything else. But I said, but you shouldn't underwrite it based on Airbnb. You should underwrite it based on regular long-term rents for that area, because a municipality can change, rules with Airbnb can change, demand for Airbnb can change. But if you so in that case, that person was pricing it on the most optimistic use, which has been, you know, Airbnbs in the last several years have done extremely well, but they're starting, you know, the last year or so, they've started to lag and not do as well. If all of your underwriting and your loan is based on that Airbnb income, and now all of a sudden you can find yourself underwater or coming out of pocket. That's kind of why I do the three case scenarios. And then in this case, I would have, you know, I advised them, look, base it on the most realistic scenario, which is that at some point, you know, it might be a long term rental, even because you might get tired of managing it. Right?
Correct. Exactly.
That happened to me. Well, and it
happens to a lot of people, you know, and when you look at an area and you look at some properties and when those properties come into the market, a lot of them have to do with, especially on something like multifamily, which is very, very taxing to the manager. And if you're not hiring a management company and you're doing it, you get to a point where it's like, I wanna have my weekends back. I wanna have my, you know, depending on those things. Some of those things that we have mentioned in other podcasts is a, you know, user error, or this is where the CapEx is important. A lot of the investment that you make up front is so that you could save yourself the time of having to continually fix little things that come up in a property. But you made a point about how there are some of those loans that you could do for multifamily. So, you know, in the residential side of the loan world, you know, you have government-backed loans, and there are some government-backed loans for commercial properties, but they're limited to multifamily through agencies. The majority of the loans are portfolio, you know, private commercial lenders. You know, that's another interesting, you know, difference between the two. So what else do you take into consideration in your underwriting?
So after I do that, if everything looks good so far, then I calculate my projections for the area based on trends that I'm seeing, based on if I know there's zoning changes coming up, et cetera. So then, and that's where I do my...
But how do you quantify that? How do you quantify that into a number? Or is it more of... This is more of let me really understand what's happening in the area and what the potentiality is. This might be a best case scenario kind of a world, but at the worst case, the zoning is good, the area is good, it's growing.
That's exactly
that kind of a thing.
How I look at it. So I look at an area. There's an area that I really like now, and I looked at the location. I looked at the current demographics. I looked at the surrounding demographics.
Yeah.
And this is just a place where the natural put, there's no place else for people to go. It's kind of like, I feel like Broward County and Fort Lauderdale especially are really having their moment after decades. I mean, since I've been here, 35 years, it's been or Miami-Dade or Palm Beach, and a lot of people just skipped Broward altogether. Mm-hmm. Not sure why. I always think it's a marketing thing that the county had where people didn't really understand that Fort Lauderdale was not part of Miami Dade or part of Palm Beach. But now they're having their moment. Why? Yeah. Because of the Brightline and because people getting priced out of Miami Dade and priced out of Palm Beach found this beautiful donut hole, that same lifestyle, same general everything that you have
and
in either
only
of those
for
counties.
It's multiple municipalities within
Broward.
But
that's what I mean.
I mean,
Broward County as a whole. I'm just focusing on Fort Lauderdale because there have been so many articles recently about how many young families are moving to the downtown area. But yeah, Broward County for sure as a whole has been booming. So I look at that, I calculate the projections, and then I look at where I think rents will be 1 year, 3 year, and 5 years out. You know, how much do I think they're going to appreciate? I try to be very conservative. You know, not every year do you get a 15 to 20% bump like we saw during COVID, obviously. Sure. And that this is the point where I do my best, worst, and most likely scenario. And then based on that, after that, that's where I start going in for the financing. I've created my story of the property, my story of what I'm going to do, my story based on where it is today and where I think it can be 3 years from now, 5 years from now.
Yeah. Now, one thing that is important is, like, when we're looking at the way that these deals are underwritten, sometimes you run into this scenario where you have a property, it is, you know, it checks off all the marks. It is very, very much under rented. You know, the rents are well below market. Mm-hmm. And there's a million reasons why that happens. You know, oftentimes what happens is the property is free and clear. It's been owned for 20, 30 years. And the owners just haven't really kept up with increasing the market. They have tenants there. The tenants don't bother them. They don't want to deal with it. So they're like, let's just, you know, we're getting this income. The tenants are happy. Nobody's bothering me.
I have a friend who owns a ton of multifamily in Little Havana, and his rents are way below market. I'd say probably like 30% below, because he's owned them for forever.
Right.
Nobody calls him in the middle of the night. They call their own plumber. They fix their own problems. Unless they can't deal with it, then he gets the call.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, that would scare me, because that means that by the time you get the call, something that might have been minor is major. But he says it's worked for him. And he goes, and I will, you know, I just, like most of his tenants have been there like 20 years. And that's the good part, right? Because he's also keeping housing affordable for the exchange. Because if he were to sell that, somebody's going to come in, bump it 30%, and all of those clients, all of those tenants who have been there 20 years, probably none of them can afford a 30% rent bump, right? So that means they're out and trying to find something else. Yeah. So,
but that makes it particularly challenging, because the appraisal process is so different in between residential and commercial. Correct. Where, you know, in the commercial, it's really about that income approach. I have found lenders that have done some creative things. I have a client who's a very well experienced multifamily, operator. Bought a multifamily. They were significantly below, you know, market. And what's really interesting is that, like I mentioned, banks are by nature very conservative. Mm-hmm. And so even though it made sense to them, yes, it's well undervalued, the rents are well below, et cetera, they wanted to hedge their bet. And even though they knew this is an experienced operator, they've lent this person money on other properties, they've seen what he can do, they basically asked them to put an additional money in escrow until those rents were within a 10 or 15% of where the market of what the projections were.
Well, and I think banks, you know, every major event, lenders get, they learn something like the rest of us, right?
Yeah.
So I think after the financial crisis, banks learned something. I think after COVID, banks learned something. I mean, let's be honest. If I had done something before COVID, my worst case scenario wouldn't have covered having tenants in there that don't have to pay rent and that I can't evict and, you know, nobody coming back to office. And, you know, and I don't think a bank did either. So, but now they learned that, right? So,
But you and I we've had this discussion where those that had loans that were CMBS loans,
right?
The commercial mortgage-backed securities, they didn't have the same experience as those that had commercial lenders that were local regional banks.
Correct.
And partly is because, as I mentioned, the bank is your partner in that investment. And what happened is the banks worked. The commercial lenders worked with their client because they're an investor in the deal.
Right. And just for people who aren't clear, because I know we have all kinds of listeners at all levels here. So a commercial mortgage-backed securities has, they package mortgages together and then sell them to a group of investors. So it's not like a bank is holding the loan. It's a group of investors holding a bunch of different loans.
Correct.
So that's why the negotiation is so different.
They're limited. Now the difference there, again, another point you're killing it in this podcast. You kill it every time, but you're killing is that, for example, in the residential loan, you usually will get a 15 and a 30 year mortgage. It's all straight up the way it's set up. You're going to pay the same interest rate, you know, for 30 years. You're not going to have any adjustments, you know. In commercial, you're going to have 5 to 10 year, you know, loan terms that are amortized over 20 years. So, you know, basically, I'm going to guarantee you this rate for 5 years. It's going to adjust after 5 years, but I will divide up the payments as if you were having a 20 year, you know, loan. So that way your payments are more attainable, you know, but the rate will adjust. And so you have to, you know, you have to maneuver. And of course, they can't really change the terms on the CMBS, to your point, because it's a security. There are multiple investors that own that. And so they just, those rules don't allow for that. The lender has the ability to say, why don't we push this a little further in the future and add a year or two to your mortgage? And let's work together, you know, let's cover this, let's cover that. There, I mean, there was a lot of creativity, you know,
for sure, with local banks. And that's when I look at financing. So when I look at how I'm going to finance a deal, it's kind of, do I do conventional or do I get creative? Creative is usually syndication, friends and family, IRAs, 401ks, all that kind of stuff. Or do I get a straight loan? If I'm getting a straight loan, I look at loan to value, because obviously the lower my down payment, the higher cash on cash. I obviously look at the interest rate. Is it adjusting, or is there a portion where I can do interest only? Because again, if I can do interest only, then that helps me with my cash flow, especially in the first couple of years when I'm doing maybe the CapEx. So, you know, it's how you put all of these different puzzle pieces together and connect all of the dots into this overall investment. I also want to look at, to your point, the amortization. The lower the amortization period, amortization is just the time that you write off the loan over. To your point, in resi, it's 30 or 15. In commercial, it's usually 15 to 20 or 25 to 30, depending on the asset class.
And to your point, again, multifamily, especially in some of those programs, you could get a 4-year.
Correct.
You know, depending on the size of it and all the other factors.
And the reason I look at that is because the lower the amortization rate, the time frame is, the lower my cash flow is, right? Because I'm paying more towards my mortgage for the write-off. And then I always look at whether there's a prepayment penalty, because in most residential mortgages, there is not a prepayment penalty, but in a lot of commercial loans, there are prepayment penalties.
Right.
And the reason I look at that, and I look at the balloon date, and the balloon date is the date that your payment comes due. And by the way, your balloon date and your amortization date aren't the same, right? You can have a 15-year amortization period with a 5-year balloon.
Right.
So you need to consider that, because that's going to affect what you do with your property. If it's a long-term hold property, where do you think you're going to be at the time your balloon payments due?
Correct.
How do you think you're going to refinance?
Yeah.
If it's a long-term hold, but you want to do a cash out refi in year 3.
Yeah.
And a cash out refi is, I read this in The Real Deal. I can't remember who the quote's from, but you know how The Real Deal does those crazy things
those
people
little,
said. Somebody wrote that cash out refis are better than sex. And I thought that was hilarious, because so few people use cash out refi. And that's one of the famous, famous ways to accumulate and escalate how rapidly your wealth grows, is through real estate investment and cash out refis. But I digress. But you want to make sure.
And you bring something up that is important, which is going back to it. When you go to a bank to get a commercial loan, you don't get a pre-qualification letter. You get a term sheet.
Right.
And just like the terms of the contract to buy the property, the term sheet is negotiable. And so, to your point about there is always, almost always, right, very common, let's just put it this way, to have a prepayment penalty in a commercial loan, there are also ways in which you could say, okay, so you want me to have this penalty, how about we do a step-down penalty?
Right.
Where now I know the longer I own it and I operate it at a certain level, then, you know, my penalty gets lower and lower so that, you know, if I have a seven-year horizon for disposing of the asset, and then at that point, you know, my penalty is going to be a lot lower than at the beginning. So there are ways in which you can negotiate that away, but those are important components because you don't want to be thinking about that after the fact. I'll just add one more thing. You know, I think the bank, when it came to putting extra money for the rents to go up in the example of my client, there was also the other option was, okay, we'll just lend you less money.
Right.
We'll just do a lower loan to value. So everything kind of becomes negotiable.
Right.
Go ahead.
So I wanted to ask you, because we're comparing, right? And since you were in the residential mortgage,
yeah,
and this goes back to your point of how in a commercial transaction, the bank and lender is really a partner with you.
Yeah.
So that means their instrument and your relationship with them is negotiable. That's not the case, at least from my experience, in residential mortgages.
Not at all.
You take it or leave it.
Take it or leave it. Right.
I don't get to negotiate a lot of the terms.
And the reality is that even if you shop around the rate, which I always thought was a you know, what's really an unfair process that was set up where, you know, you go to one bank, then you go to another. But the reality, the difference in the rates are usually not a huge difference. What becomes a difference is, you know, depending on the type of loan, yeah, they're you know, if they're going to charge you points in order to get to a rate, stuff like that. But the reality is that it is what it is. The terms are what is determined. It's a government-backed, loan. So if you're using Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, you know, you got to follow their guidelines. And
right,
you either fit in that box or you don't fit in that box. And I'll give you an example of one in which we sold a property that when the property was developed, it was an association. It was developed as an association, as a condo association. It was a row of villas, right? You know, basically 14 townhomes. So there were 7 lots and they just built them, you know, with one wall that was connecting the two of them. They had a little bit of a pretty nice yard, all that stuff. It was built back in the early 80s. Well, I think at the time the developer developed it in that way because there was a benefit to having it as a condo and being able to develop everything at one shot. But then basically that condo was never utilized. Mm-hmm. People bought the property. Yeah, they were part of a condo. There was no monthly payment. You were on your own to do all the maintenance, all that other stuff. So for, you know, the past 20 years, that property, and that wasn't enough to satisfy the requirements of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You know, and in this case, it was a Fannie Mae loan. We had to go through a variety of different options to see how we can make it happen, including asking a residential owner to buy a liability insurance policy for $1 million in case there was any issues with the neighbor next door, all that stuff. Well, listen, at the end of the day, it didn't quite work out, and the buyer had to go and get a private loan, you know, a hard equity loan in order to acquire the property. So, you know, some of those guidelines in a bank, the bank would be reasonable, would be like, okay, let's do this. We need an affidavit. We need this and that in lieu of a dissolution of that condo, you know, because in reality, what all those owners should have done is get together. We're going to dissolve the condo. Everything here is going to be fee simple. And then we don't have to worry about this, you know, forever again. But anyhow. Like you said, we digress.
No, but that gave me a good idea for another topic, for another episode. So that's why I was writing
this. I love it.
So then my final thing, and I kind of covered it a little bit, is what's my exit? Even if it's a long-term hold, you kind of figure an exit cap at either year 5 or year 10, even if you're going to hold it for 30 years, just to give you the numbers.
You know, that's very important because it's different for every investor. offer, and that, like they said, you make your money when you buy the asset, right? But you need to have in your mindset what is really going to be your exit strategy as an investment.
Well, and I would almost, even though that's kind of the way that I go, the process of the underwriting, I usually calculate my exit strategy, or I at least have an idea of my exit strategy before I start thinking about the financing, because that's going to dictate a lot of what I negotiate with the lender, right? Because to my point earlier, if I'm going to do a cash out refi, if I have a prepayment penalty before I'm going to take out my cash out refi, that's going to affect it. So maybe I have the pre-penalty line up to the year before, or then I know that, okay, my cash out refi is going to have to wait until the prepayment period is over, whatever. So,
you know, the cash out refi is great because you could get your money back and you're, you know, and now you're making money on that asset. You have leverage.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole episode, I think, on the rich dad, poor dad loopholes theory, because that's what I'm trying to get my kids to do, right?
what I hope people get out of this episode is that everything that you have mentioned has come from a point of view, meaning that every investor has a different point of view. Some are looking at pure appreciation, location. There are people that want trophy assets in trophy locations, and they're willing to buy for less than a 2% cap rate just to be in that location because they are bullish on the valuation of, you know, the appreciation of that asset. Right. There are those that are purely cash flow, and if it doesn't cash flow, it doesn't work. Some don't want to do value add. They don't want to, you know, go through that nightmare. So they're willing to take, you know, a lower cap rate, meaning they're going to make less of a return, but they don't have to do that work. And, you know, and some people want to add value. They want to, you know, roll up their sleeves like you are and make that stuff. What is detrimental to investing in commercial real estate, in my point of view, is not having a point of view, not having, for lack of a better word, a thesis as an investor of what do I want to invest to, what kind of assets, in what location, and why, and where, why am I bullish on this, on this approach? Oftentimes, as brokers, we get called from people that says, you know, I have X amount of money, I wanna make an investment. Where do you want to invest?
Anywhere
in South Florida.
What kind of asset class?
South Florida is kind of very large, you know.
What kind of asset class?
Any asset class. But or they'll tell you, I like this and I like that, but I'm open to anything. You know, I just want to see a great deal. Well, the reality is that
How much money do you want to invest? It depends on the deal.
Yeah, correct. and but the reality is, and here's the truth of it. The truth of it is that even if I bring you the greatest deal, you will not recognize it. And the reason why you won't recognize it is because you don't have a point of view. It doesn't, you have to have a criteria.
That's what I was going to say. So I have very specific criteria.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm willing to give up on one or two of them if there's something else, but there's three, you know, like there's certain ones that I don't give up. And if I am going to give them up and I say, okay, well, this location doesn't have great transportation access, or this one is too far from commercial center, or whatever that criteria is, I really want to do a deep dive into why I'm willing to give it up.
Right.
Because even, you know, commercial investments really should be, unlike, well, my client would totally disagree, they shouldn't be emotional. And that's a huge difference between home ownership and owning a residential property that you live in versus a commercial asset. And having that criteria and those guidelines, it's like when you're bowling, it's having bumpers on your alley when you're learning to bowl, so you can go straight down and hit the bullseye versus, you know, jumping over three lanes and taking out your bowling neighbor.
So you see, she's conflicted about, you know, a few things, but not about her point of view and about her perspective. And the only time that she has strayed away from her perspective has been when she chose me as her partner. So that's the only, you know, but
well, sometimes you know, we all deserve a break. Sometimes you just have to go with your gut, and it's a leap of faith. And I'm so glad I did. Not everything in life can be planned.
You're absolutely right. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us on another episode of Between Two Chairs. We are delighted that you are here. We hope that you got a lot out of this. As she mentioned, we don't plan these things. And somehow they just come together and it we works
hope,
out.
We hope.
I think
at
it's
least
one of
that's
my favorites. Yeah, we hope exactly right. I guess it is in the ear of the listener instead of the eye of the beholder. Bye, everybody. Say bye, Jennifer.
Bye, Jennifer. Oh, bye.